This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I want you to know that I once had vanity license plates that said Go Blue, but I had to spell it B-L-O-O, which was kind of odd.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Ashton Kutcher of Education Policy, Rick S.
Hey, Mike. Although I'm not really the Ashton Kutcher because I was here first.
Yeah?
So I'm really more the Charlie Sheen.
What do you mean you were here first? You mean you've been on the scene for a while? Who's knocking
on the
you
show?
Off?
No. On the Gadfly podcast.
I see.
I'm more like the Charlie Sheen.
Yep.
And all of the Sarah Meads and the Janie Skulls who roll in and show me up.
I see.
They're all like kind of shoveling dirt on my Charlie Sheen-like grave.
We do talk about killing you off. Not for real, but on the show.
Sometimes. Winning.
Oh. So, you know, big pop culture weekend for you because you actually watch television, unlike me. We don't actually have a comfortable place to sit in front of our television.
Even right in now. The new house?
Yeah, because we don't have that much furniture and the new house is bigger. And anyways,
you should
have
got a big puffy TV watching couch.
Well, at some point, maybe we will.
But make that a priority.
Yeah, well. Anyways, so, but you were happy with how that Modern Family did well?
I'm glad Modern Family did well. I do feel like How I Met Your Mother never comes anywhere close to what it should be winning on those Emmys.
That is a good show. I've seen it a few times.
There you go.
And what did I hear about this, that Steve Carell never got an Emmy for his work?
That's what I hear from Joe.
Yeah.
Who's working the boards here.
Outrage.
But you know what I'd read that, which I didn't realize, that George Costanza, played by Jason Alexander on Seinfeld, went unrecognized the entire run of Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. So
it's not just the education system that screwed up.
Although, you know the record holder in this kind of category.
Yes.
Susan Lucci, baby. She went, what, like 25 years on one of those soap operas where she was like the queen of daytime until she finally won something? Craziness.
Crazy.
You know the best book on all this stuff?
What's that?
Bill Carter, New York Times media guys, done three terrific books on the network wars. You learn more. I learned more about how to think about education and how much weight you can actually put on practices that are deemed to work and on analytic and media results than I have from all of the stacks of ed stuff I've read over
the
last decade.
Which is what, very little?
How?
Because they have no idea how to replicate successes.
They know nothing. Do you know, every show that you think about as blockbuster in the last decade, American Idol, Survivor, Desperate Housewives, all of these were passed on by at least one network, which said there's no way that'll work.
Yep. Yep. Book publishing, similar deal, right?
Nobody wanted Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess we should talk about education a little bit here, huh? Not that we weren't. I mean, I guess that kind of tied in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In other words, we don't know anything.
Maybe anywhere
in the
world.
That makes people think that think tanks aren't that valuable as a result. We don't have a clue. All right. Danielle, should we play some Pardon the Gadfly?
On that note, I'll ask you guys some questions about the things you know.
Okay. Well, sort of.
It's going to be a very small question.
Yeah, exactly.
This week, Fordham released its latest, Do High Flyers Maintain Their Altitude? The Performance of High Achievers. And National Affairs released a big article by Rick arguing that our obsession with closing achievement gaps has been misguided. A coincidence or a conspiracy?
Oh.
Well, I'm sure what we know will be said by some of our friends on the a gap closing bus.
Yes, which is what?
This was all carefully orchestrated.
Yes, exactly. And there's a Jay Green study coming soon that will also show that our highest performing districts are not internationally competitive. So this is just like all around. It is a conspiracy.
What it really shows is just that we are so slow that it takes us a decade to get around to actually starting to meaningful challenge when we overshoot on these things.
All right. So what our study shows is we track individual students over time. This is using the NWEA assessment. And it shows that, for example, kids that are in third grade and are high performing at the 90th percentile or above, that a lot of them by the eighth grade are no longer high performing at the 90th percentile or above, that they drop out of this high performing status. And it's quite a few. In some categories, it's close to half the kids. Hard to know what to make of that, whether you'd expect more or less. Seems like a lot to us. You also have some evidence that in reading, particularly middle school to high school reading, you see the high performers totally stagnating while the low performers keep making progress. Some people say, hey, great, that's closing the achievement gap. I would say, hey, what are we doing? That's slowing down the progress of our high achievers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's your argument over there in National Affairs?
It's broader. I say, look, achievement gap, what I call achievement gap mania, is fine as far as it goes. Focusing resources and energy on the worst served kids, makes sense. Nobody's got any obvious problem with it. The real danger has been that the champions of this stuff on both sides of the aisle have made it more or less impossible in the last decade for people to talk about any of the other kids other than those at the bottom of the achievement gaps. This is all the funders want to focus on. It's all the charters emphasize. It's all state accountability systems emphasize and reward upon. And so what's happened is we've created an environment where all we talk about, all we research, all we study, all we intervene upon is reading and math performance for the lowest performing, for low performing disadvantaged kids. And the result is the kinds of results that your study at FLAG this week have simply, we haven't done this kind of research. We haven't actually wrestled with the implications of these kinds of trade-offs. And we haven't been honest about the fact that when we make these decisions, some kids are going to lose out as we direct our attention on other kids.
But the other side, say Education Trust or others, will say, no, let's talk of trade-offs. There's no reason we can't walk and chew gum at the same time. We can lift the achievement of all kids.
Yeah, and I mean, so a lot of the article is walking through the reams of evidence that we actually can't.
That we can't. There are trade-offs.
That there's limited resources. There's limited instructional energy. There's limited time.
Look, and I think, there's the policy stuff, but I think at the end of the day, it's also what's happening within schools. Mm-hmm. So, for example, around grouping, the war against tracking, which was understandable. There were kids, especially poor minority kids, in tracks to nowhere, getting nothing, and blowing that up made sense. But what we have now is an ideology that says we should always have heterogeneous grouping. Other two otherwise is elitist or classist or racist, and what do you know? There are trade-offs that might be good for the low-achieving kids, but the high-achieving kids are bored silly.
Well, the third word there is the payoff word. To challenge the gap-closing emphasis has been to be attacked as racist for the better part of the past decade.
Right.
And that has made it incredibly hard to have any serious debate about how do we structure programs, how do we serve kids. I got to say, I mean, I think this is one reason why NCLB so thoroughly unraveled. Both as a policy consensus, but also as a political project, that all these suburban communities, which are seeing their property values slammed and are seeing their schools really emphasize serving just a wedge of kids who are not making AYP, who are stopping the schools from making AYP, those parents, these middle class, these suburban parents are saying, this isn't about my kid. And that's not how you maintain a coalition when it comes to American social policy.
Okay, topic number two.
This past Friday, the federal government announced the creation of its Digital Promise private-public partnership initiative, which will fund R&D for digital ed. Is this a top-notch idea from the feds or a surefire way to strangle the virtual ed movement in its cradle?
You know, Jay Green had a great post on this week, comparing this to the solar power company that has been in the news of late. This sounds like picking winners and losers. Reed Hastings co-authored an op-ed with Arne Duncan today in the Wall Street Journal in favor of this. He's usually a thoughtful guy, libertarian leaning. I don't get it. What are we missing here? Why would we want the federal government anywhere near this stuff?
So let's talk a bit about what Digital Promise actually involves. So, right. I mean, what does this actually mean?
Yeah, Daniela?
That's a really good question. They'll be funding, research and development is their big thing. So they'll be funding, like Mike said, different potentially positive initiatives and in theory then making, having a what works clearinghouse type experience where they'll, have out information on this is a great program in, curriculum development or in X or in Y.
I mean, historically, right? I mean, if we think about the kinds of research where I think the government has actually played a really positive role in the last, say, half century or more, it's generally basic research. Mm-hmm. It's the stuff, right? It's a public good that when you learn basic stuff about drug interactions, when you learn basic stuff about the properties of materials, it's hard for companies to patent all the applications. So therefore, companies tend to underinvest in that kind of basic research. Mm-hmm. Companies tend to do a really good job of taking this basic science and turning it into useful stuff that they can go sell. So where we've seen the federal government generally invest through the NIH, through the National Science Foundation, is in basic science, basic research. And I think that stuff has been, enormously positive. I mean, right? I mean, Internet started out out of DARPA as a federal research initiative. Where I'm less optimistic about the government role is when it starts getting not into research, but actual into development and trying to help get materials to market. That's, you know, actually, that's the Solyndra stuff where the government's offering loan guarantees to particular providers, because then you got to pick who's got the best business plan, who's going to. And I don't know enough about Digital Promise right now myself to know which side of the R&D line it's really emphasizing.
I don't know if there's a lot of information out yet, if they've really come out with a full scale, you know, long 100-page blueprint exactly detailing it.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's always been this controversy, people saying, you know, we don't have much D in the R&D apparatus in education. And the question is there a governmental role? School districts are so fragmented and most are too small to invest in that sort of thing. States aren't investing. So you say, well, if the feds don't invest, it's completely up to the private sector and it's hard to turn a profit in K-12. So there's just nothing there. But I think your distinction makes sense, Rick, is you know, clearly there has been investment in K-12 digital learning lately. Some would say there's a rush to invest in that, maybe even a bubble. Not sure what role the feds have right now and why we think they're going to make better decisions than these private investors are going to make when they've got their own money at stake.
But, you know, as much as I love Jay, I do worry sometimes that, you know, when we think of, for instance, about federal investment in highways and roads, that, you know, at least for me, I think there is a sensible federal role in research and infrastructure. And what I worry is that we have too much fun just taking shots at everything, because I think there's been lots of pork in the Obama administration agenda. And I have lots of problems with how the president terms everything he wants to spend money on an investment. Yeah. So I think I don't blame conservatives for taking shots at it, but I don't want to see us throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay, topic number three.
Pearson has been making headlines of late. This week alone saw the company announce the acquisition of Connections Education and also come under scrutiny for expensive trips abroad for state education commissioners, underwritten by the company's philanthropic arm. Should we be excited or nervous about Pearson's activities?
Well, first of all, another week, another group making some real money off of education. I assume the folks at Connections Academy now cashed in pretty well. Mickey Revenaugh and others that we know who've been leading that. It's kind of a slew now. We've got Wireless Generation out there. We got the SchoolNet folks. So you can turn to, you now to have examples of people making, you know, serious fortunes in K-12 education.
Although, you know, it's funny. Larry Berger's piece for me a couple years ago, the one on the barriers to entrepreneurship, one of the things he did talk about was the limited exit strategies. And he pointed out that the only viable exit strategy most of these for-profits had was to sell to one of the big publishers.
Yeah.
So, you know, so now it's exciting. We've got News Corp in buying up some other stuff too, but that was a sarcastic, actually, about it's exciting. Because, look, I mean, the problem is that you really do have a relatively, you've got an oligopoly here, and there's just not a lot of room for folks to really come in with new sustainable business models and challenge the big boys in an ongoing way. And I think I think we'd all be better off. It'd be a more vibrant marketplace if there were.
Yeah, and, you know, so I have these impulses, just as you can worry about big government overreaching and making poor decisions. Same with these big textbook companies. Pearson seems to be gobbling up a bigger and bigger market share and is being very aggressive about opportunities in digital learning related to Common Core. Could be that this makes sense, that it's integrating all this stuff well, that it's bringing a lot of potential. I just don't know. And I feel like it's one of these things it's involved, got its fingers in so many places. There's very little public transparency.
Well, it's funny, for all of the Jeremiads that, you know, that friends of ours like Diane Ravitch and Debbie Meyer launch at, you know, the billionaires in education.
Yeah.
It's amazing how little just reasonable scrutiny there is of the big for-profit providers.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Ed Week doesn't write a lot of stories about these guys. You don't really see much analysis of what they do, of their market caps. It's just not part of the education conversation.
Right. And and whether when they translate some of these things that are, you know, somewhat via public policy, say Common Core, and that goes through the Pearson machine and whatever their perspective on education is a product that comes out on the other side pretty good or not. And then, you know, look, they're being, you know, I understand they're being savvy. They got their own foundation and they're working it to find ways to get their the nonprofit and for-profit guys to work together. I mean, none of this is surprising, right? It just says, look, it might be fine. I just want to see more transparency out there.
And I got to say, I mean, what's funny is when I saw that they acquired Connections Academy, I misread it the first time. I thought they had acquired Connecticut. I thought they just bought the state. Saved. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
That's a whole new Pearson laboratory.
I think in Connecticut's fiscal state, actually, they could get it for cents on the dollar.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking they could call it like Pearson it.
Yeah. Well, I like that. All right, that's all the time we've got, because, man, we were really substantive today.
Oof, we'll have to not do too much of that.
I know.
We know our listeners don't come here. Although, it is funny that, you know, every time we get these little emails in, we realize, like, how influential the listenership is for the podcast. And you're like, it's constantly kind of frightening.
Yeah, yeah. No, kind of fun. Hey, we didn't even get to talk about your appearance by Mayor Villaraigosa.
Dude, he is impressive.
Yeah.
Chip, folks should check out the URL of his AEI talk on the AEI website. I was really best thing I asked him. All right. He was talking about, look, we've got to be willing to spend more on schools. That the Republicans, he said, have got that wrong. But he said, you know, we can't just be talking about tepid, half-baked reforms. We've got to really make sure that every dollar spent is having an impact. And I can live with that deal. But I asked him, all right, well, you've talked a lot about the UTLA. What promising signs have you seen on the part of the UTLA over the last 6 years? And he said, none.
Wow. That does not sound like a politician's answer.
I was really impressed.
Love it. Love it. Okay. Well, it is now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here as always.
Did you watch the Emmys the other night?
I did watch the Emmys. Absolutely enjoyed it very much. Thought Jane Lynch did a nice job as host.
Yeah. And and are you a Glee fan?
Very much a Glee fan. Mm. Yeah. Just got to get into those musicals, you know, sing-alongs.
Uh-huh. Plus the high school theme.
High school theme. Absolutely.
You know, I've just started watching Friday Night Lights, by which I mean I watched like the first half hour of the first show. But it's really good, and I plan to keep doing it.
And now it's canceled.
And it's canceled.
And
why
it's
is this?
Great show, but you know, he won and he deserved it. So
why
Kyle Chandler? I have no idea. I mean, I thought I had a pretty consistent loyal following, but I don't know if it was the Friday night slot or what, but it's a great show.
Maybe high school football got so popular that nobody was watching TV anymore.
Perhaps.
All right. What are you talking about here today, Amber?
A new study by Richard Ingersoll on recruitment and retention of minority teachers. There's been some concern that our teaching workforce does not reflect the diversity of our nation and that minority kids don't have enough teachers who understand their cultural backgrounds. So Ingersoll used data from the nationally representative SAS survey from the last 20 years, as well as data from the teacher follow-up survey. Not surprisingly, he finds a gap between the percentage of minority students and the percentage of minority teachers, but says it's largely been due to the number of white students decreasing while minority students increase. So that's no surprise. Says it's not a failure to recruit minority teachers. In fact, he finds the number of K-12 teachers has increased greatly since the 80s, and minority teachers have nearly doubled, which was twice the growth rate of white teachers. We know the K-12 population has overall increased roughly about 19% over the last 20 years. Minority students increased by 73% over the last 20 years. White students decreased by 2%. Number of minority males, I thought this was interesting. More minority male teachers increased by 92% over the last 20 years. White males increased by about 18%. So we're getting more male teachers. Got to be a good thing. Minorities, however, leave at higher rates than whites and migrate more between schools. Sort of some interesting data there. He kind of dug in and found that school working conditions were mostly to blame. A lot of minority teachers obviously working hard to staff schools. They say they're, you know, they don't have as much autonomy and whatnot. So he closes on a positive note. He says that, you know, changing working conditions may be easier than increasing salaries for teachers. So we'll see.
Interesting. Lots to unpack here. First of all, Richard Ingersoll, he loves the SAS, doesn't
yes,
he?
Yes, loves the SAS. He has got some control, I hear, over the SAS variables.
Yes, he milks the SAS for all it's worth. Isn't that true? Very sassy. So I wish we could get this information a little bit broken out. I mean, by talking just about minorities, I mean, of course, the big change in demographics has been the growth of Latino students. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see this big, huge increase in minority students. I mean, maybe a little bit of an increase in African-Americans, but not nearly the same order. And, you know, if you're Latino, are you any better off with an African-American teacher than a white teacher?
Right,
or
right.
Likewise, if you're black and you have a Latino teacher. I mean, that just seems like a strange way to group it. So,
I mean,
if the point is there might be some benefit of having somebody of the same race, and there's been some research that has found that there is, you know, all else being equal, there is some benefit to having a teacher of your own race. So I wish he could unpack that a little bit
for us. Maybe he will. I don't know. I mean, this was a pretty big study, and maybe he's got subsequent plans. I don't know.
He does like doing studies on the pass.
Yes, he does. Well, he's, you know, he's a big teacher retention recruitment scholar.
Yes.
So this is right in his bailiwick.
And look, this is interesting that about this retention issue that, you know, we actually, look, pat ourselves on the back. We've done a better job of recruiting minority teachers into the mm-hmm. classroom. Mm-hmm. But we tend to send them into the toughest schools and they don't stay.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, so that follow-up survey was pretty neat that we can kind of bear down into why teachers leave and just kind of see that, you know, there's some, you know, discontent there. And it's probably true, you know, maybe in these urban schools where it's sort of taking a more heavy-handed approach with instruction, trying to get, you know, more into teachers' business in terms of controlling those types of things. So it makes sense, you know, that those are what the data show.
Yeah. All right. Well, what song goes along with this?
All
Amber?
Right. So since we've clearly begun making strides in our recruitment of minority teachers, We've Only Just Begun by the Carpenters.
We've only just begun to live. White lace and promises. A kiss for luck and we're on our way. We've only begun.
Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes, sir.
Chris, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. How's it going, guys?
Yeah, so Michigan 2-0.
3-0.
Oh,
whoa.
Sorry. 3-0.
Look at you, baby.
Man, I was trying to look like I knew what I was talking about with sports.
Go Big Blue.
That's right.
Although, Big Blue. What is it? Go Blue.
It's Little Blue.
They can be Big Blue.
Now,
It's Go Blue or Big Blue.
You know,
usually not together.
I want you to know that I once had license plates, vanity license plates that said Go Blue.
Really?
Wow.
But I had to spell it B-L-O-O, which was kind of odd.
Yeah.
Because B-L-U-E was taken.
Did you make little smiley faces in the twin O's?
I tried to, yeah.
Hey.
Okay, what you got for us this week, Chris?
Well, Mike, you know I wouldn't pass at a chance to talk college football, and this week I get to do just that. A recent EdWeek report highlights that a class action lawsuit on behalf of current and former football players has been filed against the NCAA for failing to adequately protect players from concussions. According to the lawsuit, quote, for over 30 years, the NCAA has failed its student athletes, choosing instead to sacrifice them on an altar of money and profits. You mean to say players getting concussions is the NCAA's fault? What's up with that? The idea that the collegiate sports governing body should financially compensate players who voluntarily strap on a helmet and take the field each day is beyond ridiculous. It is in no way the NCAA's responsibility to be monitoring the sport to an extent where concussions don't happen. It's a rough, physical, violent sport. People who choose to play it know what they're getting into when they start. I come down completely on the libertarian side of these types of issues. You know the risks going in? You can stop at any time. If you want to destroy your body for athletic glory, it's nobody's fault but your own. And even though the NCAA passed a rule in 1976 prohibiting players from leading with the head when blocking or tackling, the plaintiffs contest that the players continue to be coached to use their heads in that fashion regardless. Look, guys, if you've got a problem with illegal coaching, be a man and report it to the compliance office. For our Buckeye listeners, feel free to look up the term compliance office. If not, then there's a much easier solution for you to ensure your safety than by suing the NCAA. Stop playing football. Just like McDonald's shouldn't have been responsible when that moron spilled hot coffee on herself, the NCAA shouldn't be responsible when players who voluntarily take up football get seriously injured. Let's hope the NCAA has better luck in court than McDonald's did.
Ooh, what do you think, Rick? Do you agree with this?
Oof. Well, I wanted to, but I gotta say, You know, in fact, there was an HBO movie this spring about how that McDonald's coffee incident was actually far more actionable than we've been led to believe, that McDonald's had disregarded hundreds of warnings, blah, blah, blah. So, Chris, I mean, you're telling me that poor kids who can't afford college growing up, who are football stars, that they're supposed to just wave off the blandishments from dozens of big shot college coaches coming in saying, son, I will get you a free college education. I will put you on national TV. I will let you make millions. These 17-year-olds supposed to say, no, because I'm putting my body at risk?
Absolutely not. They should go for it. I'd go for it if I had that kind of talent.
But you're not concerned then about the NCAA maybe take
steps? It's a risk that you take.
But yeah. You don't think the NCAA could take steps here to minimize the likelihood of concussion?
I mean, they could definitely take steps in the direction that, and they are taking steps in the direction that the NFL has gone, where you take a player's helmet away after a big hit. You don't let them go back in the game. But to what they're suggesting in this lawsuit, for NCAA officials to be present at all practices, for all sorts of, just way over the top, and for financial compensation for mostly burnout players who have these concussions and now aren't making money, that's ridiculous. These guys are just trying to, grasp at this low-hanging fruit while it's there. It's out of control.
So, the K-12 angle here, it's certainly, I think, different when you're talking about high school sports. And you see that a lot of states are trying to get into this arena and do some more regulating of what happens in high school football, and I think that's appropriate. I mean, that certainly this is a serious issue, and we should be making sure that young people know the risks of what they're doing and that we minimize them, that we don't. It's crazy to have a game, I think, where kids are getting concussions on a regular basis. Look, I think that from...
And I hear in Montgomery County they've started issuing skirts to both quarterbacks and wide receivers, huh?
So you're just making fun of that. Is that what you're saying? I mean, it is crazy, right? I mean, this culture that says, oh, sure, we're just not going to worry if our teenage guys are getting regular concussions because of this game. I mean, that's silly. We've heard echoes of this before, Chris. I mean, the smoking thing was always, oh, it's a personal choice to smoke, right? But the question was whether the companies had evidence that this was dangerous and could kill you, and that they were keeping that evidence from people. I think it's the same thing. Did the NCAA know that this playing the game in this way was dangerous and did not do anything about it? I think this is not a crazy lawsuit. It may not turn out right, but I think I think they have a right to say, are they looking after their players or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think, for me, especially the bigger K-12 angle, is how do we think about, especially competitive sports, as ways to get guys excited about discipline, about teamwork, about learning? And I think, frankly, most good high school programs do a pretty good job of that.
Mm-hmm.
They make kids feel more connected to school. I think one of my problems with big, especially bowl conference, NCAA, is that I don't think we're doing a very good job of that. I think it feels very much like we're using these things as a farm league for the NFL. As I think part of the agenda here is, I'm not sure this goes very far towards actually figuring out how do you try to reinstitute the educative mission of football in college. And I'd like to see that be more of the focus.
Yeah, I'm not saying safety in football is a bad thing by any means. I'm just, the way this lawsuit is going about and the way it's worded, I just think it has a lot of dangerous consequences, especially at the K-12 level, if the NCAA has to start instituting some of these things that high school athletic leagues just do not have the capacity to institute.
Well, one thing's for sure, we're going to stop the practice of doing our regular headbutt at the end of each show. Okay, until next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.